Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and today, as you can tell from the title of today's episode, I am doing another Corey Richens trial recap. I'm going to be recapping from day 10 to the final days and the verdict. Now, I was going to get this out last week, but if you're not following me on Instagram or you're in my private Facebook group or you're part of the Patreon family, you probably missed it. I had some troubling stuff happen. And I'm talking off the cuff here again, guys, so just bear with me. But they say when it rains, it pours, and everything comes in threes. I'm dying to know what this third thing is going to be. But just to kind of recap, my car got like damaged. That was like the first thing, not that big of a deal, whatever. Dealing with insurance, yada, yada, yada. Over the weekend, my dog, she is a 9-year-old black lab. Her name is Bendy Lou. She was not acting right on Saturday. She wasn't really, and it kind of happened all of a sudden. She wasn't really wagging her tail. Her head was down. She wasn't walking around like normal. And her stomach looked like it was kind of contracting, like maybe she had to puke, but she wasn't retching or anything like that. So out of abundance of caution, we took her in. By the time we got there, she was acting totally fine because we had to drive an hour away because, fun fact, all of the emergency vets in Las Vegas apparently on the weekends are popping. They all had a 3 to 4 hour wait. So we drove to Henderson, Nevada and got her in pretty quickly, thankfully. But by the time we got there, she was acting a little bit better. She did toot. She passed some gas while we were there. And so I'm wondering if maybe what was going on was a stomach ache. However, while we were there, they did a quick ultrasound just to make sure that she didn't eat anything. And they found a very large mass in her stomach. So obviously, that's emotional. Our dogs in our household are like our family. They're like our babies. So I did not get my full episode, full-length episode recorded. I did not get my trial recap recorded, and I'm trying to play catch up in the mix of trying to figure out what is going on because Bendy was acting fine at the emergency vet. They just said to, you know, follow up with our regular vet. We went ahead and did that today, and she goes back in tomorrow to have ultrasounds done with a specialist, but they are thinking that it is stomach cancer. So I'm just kind of trying to play strong for my kids, continue my regular day job, my regular life, and not break down. But it, as you can tell, it's a little hard. Anyway, so I will be getting my full-length episode up, I promise you guys. But right now, I'm just going to go ahead and do the trial recap on the Corey Richens trial. It got spicy. There was a lot of things that came out, and things ended not quite like I anticipated they would. However, the jury did reach a verdict very quickly, which I will go over all of that. So I will quit blabbing. Thank you guys so much for being understanding and for all of the kind words and well wishes. I read them all. I saw them all on both my Facebook group as well as Instagram. And I really just appreciate your guys' patience through all of this. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into the trial recap. All right, so where I ended last time with my trial recap was on day 9. Day 10 was a long one, and it started with Eric's business partner taking the stand. The first witness of the day was Cody Wright, Eric Richens' longtime friend and business partner. Cody told jurors that he and Eric had worked together for years and eventually started their own masonry company, C&E Masonry, which had grown to employ around 90 people by the time that Eric died. Cody described Eric as hardworking and the life of the party. He also testified that in all the years that he knew Eric, he never saw Eric use drugs, whether prescription, over-the-counter, or illicit substances. During cross-examination, the defense attempted to challenge Cody's testimony by suggesting Eric had used pills or THC when he was in high school. Cody acknowledged that he had heard from other people, like rumors spreading around, that Eric experimented with those things in high school, but maintained that he had never seen him use drugs as an adult. And this is important because the defense was kind of trying to paint it out to be that Eric had some sort of secrets. Eric was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and maybe Eric had just hidden it from Cody, is kind of what they were implying as far as his drug use went. Cody also testified about a phone call that he received from Eric on Valentine's Day 2022, weeks before Eric's death, when prosecutors alleged that Corey tried to kill Eric the first time. According to Cody, Eric sounded unusually urgent and fearful during the call. Defense attorneys later attempted to have Cody's testimony limited or struck, arguing it conflicted with earlier statements, but the judge ruled that there was no contradictions and allowed the testimony to remain. Jurors were also played the 911 call Corey made the morning Eric was found unresponsive in their bedroom. In the call, Corey tells dispatchers that her husband is cold and unresponsive, and at one point she describes him as quote-unquote dead weight, while the dispatcher was trying to instruct her to move him from the bed to the floor so that she could begin CPR, as emergency responders were on their way. If you guys want to look up that 911 call, I'm sure it is all over social media or on YouTube. I am interested to know your guys' thoughts on the 911 call, whether you believe that Corey was actually performing CPR or not is a really big question that people are talking about. And so I'm naturally curious to hear your guys' thoughts. Later in the day, the jury did hear from a forensic handwriting expert named George Throckmorton, and he analyzed a signature on a term life insurance application that was connected to Eric. According to Throckmorton, there was no evidence that Eric signed the document, and he testified the signature appeared to be a, quote, simulated forgery, meaning someone attempted to copy Eric's handwriting in order to pass the signature off as genuine. However, this expert was unable to determine if it was Corey who tried to attempt to simulate Eric's signature or not, but he was able to say it was most likely not Eric. And one of the big things that he talked about was the absence of pen lifts. Now, I think we all probably can understand what a pen lift is, but typically, you know, when we are writing things or signing our names, people either lift the pen or they connect all their letters. And I will say for myself, I do not have any pen lifts typically in my personal signature. And Eric, on the other hand, did. Eric had pen lifts between his first name, his middle initial, and then his last name. Now, what is interesting is Corey Richens herself does not have any pen lifts when she signed her name. And that was something that they kind of pointed out to the jury. The jury also heard testimony about early stages of the investigation into Eric's death. Initially, investigators searched the home and surrounding area, but did not locate any drugs. It wasn't until toxicology results revealed that Eric had died from fentanyl intoxication that the investigation escalated. At that point, investigators obtained search warrants and seized phones belonging to both Eric and Corey. The jury also heard extensive testimony from Todd Gabler. Todd Gabler is a private investigator hired by Eric's sister to look into Eric's death. Gabler testified that he has worked on around 100 homicide cases throughout his career and is typically hired by the defense teams, not families or the prosecution. Gabler told jurors he met with Eric's sister and husband, Katie, and Clint Benson in April 2022 and explained that his job was to, quote unquote, find the truth, whatever the truth turned out to be. He said he warned them that the outcome might not be what they wanted to hear and that they would have to be okay and accept the findings of his investigation. During the investigation, Gabler conducted 40 to 50 interviews, speaking with Eric's friends, family members, business associates, and people connected to Corey. He also analyzed cell phone billing records, financial records, and other documents tied to the couple. Part of his work involved analyzing phone billing records from C&E Masonry, the company that Eric co-owned with Cody Wright, which C&E Stone Masonry happened to pay for the phones that both Eric and Corey used. Gabler testified that he examined records covering January through May of 2022 and May 2022 through February of 2023. Billing records show contact frequency but not message content, which he used to identify patterns in who Corey was communicating with most often during those times. According to Gabler, there were hundreds of text communications between Corey and Carmen Lauber, the woman who previously testified that she helped obtain drugs for Corey. The only two people Corey communicated with more frequently were Eric and her mother. And that's just not to include those messages that she was sending to Josh Grossman, her lover. She was using an app to message him kind of privately. It created a fake phone number for her. So those weren't included into these communications that he's talking about. Now, Gabler said the high number of contacts combined with Lauber's drug-related criminal history raised concerns for him, and he testified that he was the one that alerted the Summit County Sheriff's Office about the connection. Gabler also searched the Richens' home once it was released by law enforcement on May 8, 2023, documenting everything he did with photos and video, often using a GoPro camera while inside the home. He testified that he scanned thousands of documents and recorded the searches, and anything that he believed might be evidence was ultimately collected by law enforcement rather than taken by him. So if he found something, he called the cops, they came in to collect it. During his investigation, Gabler said he sometimes alerted investigators when he found items that could be of importance, recalling four or five times when he contacted police to return to the home after discovering something potentially relevant. He also testified that the information flow was largely one-directional, with him providing information to investigators but receiving little from them in return, something he said is common in cases like this. During cross-examination, defense attorney Kathy Nestor questioned Gabler about several aspects of his investigation, including his searches of the home, his handling of documents he found there, and whether he tracked vehicles connected to Corey and members of her family using GPS devices. Gabler acknowledged placing tracking devices on Corey's car, her mother's car, and her brother's car, and said the information gathered was turned over to law enforcement. The defense also questioned Gabler about reviewing Eric's text messages, including exchanges between Eric and a friend named Bryce that contained joking references to sexual acts. Gabler testified that he interpreted the messages as friends joking with each other and said he did not find evidence of sexting or an affair between the two men. And that is something that you guys are going to have to go and like watch this clip on Court TV, because the moment Kathy Nestor is questioning these things, I was sitting there wondering, like, there's no way, there is just no way that she is implying that Eric and his friend Bryce were having a romantic relationship. Like, there's just no way. And then sure enough, that is exactly what she meant. And my mind was blown. And that was the end of day 10. Day 11 was largely consumed by legal arguments as prosecutors continued working toward the end of their case. The day took an unexpected turn after a dispute over evidence forced court to recess early. Much of the morning was spent outside of the presence of the jury as attorneys argued about whether prior interviews from key witness Carmen Lauber should be shown to jurors. Carmen had already testified in the trial, but prosecutors now want to introduce portions of interviews she previously gave to investigators as Detective Jeff O'Driscoll prepares to take the stand. The defense objected, arguing that if the prosecution is allowed to submit some of those interview clips, the entire set of interviews should be included for context, nearly 1,000 pages of transcripts. After hearing arguments from both sides, the judge ruled that some of the interviews can be admitted during Detective O'Driscoll's testimony, but not the full transcripts requested by the defense. Following that ruling, defense attorneys asked the court for a 2-day continuance to review the material and prepare. The judge denied that request, but did agree to a 1-day continuance. Before wrapping up for the day, digital forensic expert Chris Kotrademus briefly returned to the stand to clarify information about text message timestamps previously shown to the jury. He explained that the forensic software records times in UTC, meaning the timestamps seen in reports must be adjusted several hours to reflect Utah's local time. After answering a few questions from prosecutors, the defense declined to cross-examine him, bringing testimony to an early stop for the day. Before dismissing everyone, jurors were told to go home and return the following day at 1 p.m. The attorneys and judge were to meet the following morning at 8:30 a.m. without the jury present to finalize the evidentiary issues before testimony resumes in the afternoon. On day 12, Carmen Lauber returned to the stand in the afternoon and faced additional questioning from the defense, who focused on inconsistencies in her story and her probation history. Jurors heard that she had previously been arrested for driving on a suspended license and was hoping to receive help on her own charges in exchange for cooperating with investigators. Detectives testified that Carmen initially minimized her involvement before eventually stating that Corey had reached out to her for pain pills. The defense also questioned Carmen about alleged probation violations, including alcohol use and a firearm being found in her room. Prosecutors, meanwhile, sought to reinforce her credibility and maintain that her overall account has remained consistent. Later in the day, Summit County Sheriff's Detective Jeff O'Driscoll took the stand. He walked jurors through text messages, phone records, and other investigative findings, including how law enforcement ultimately identified Carmen Lauber as a potential source of fentanyl. He testified detectives discovered Eric Richens' obituary displayed prominently in Carmen's room during a search of her home. Jurors also heard recorded calls involving Corey, along with emails and messages related to her children's grief book. They also heard that the sheriff's office received a copy of Corey's book sent anonymously with the note that read, quote, "There are two sides to every story. This is the true Corey, a devoted wife and adoring mother. Thought you should know. From Anonymous," end quote. The sheriff's office served a subpoena to Amazon and learned that the book came from Lisa Darden, Corey's mother. Lastly, prosecutors presented the infamous Walk the Dog letter, which is a handwritten document investigators discovered during a search of Corey Richens' personal items. These personal items were located in her jail cell, but they couldn't say that during the trial. Detective O'Driscoll testified that the multi-page note appeared to contain instructions directed toward family members about what should be said to investigators and in court. Prosecutors introduced the document as part of their effort to show Corey's alleged attempts to shape the narrative while she was in custody. During cross-examination, defense attorney Kathy Nestor focused heavily on details contained in the handwritten Walk the Dog letter. She questioned Detective Jeff O'Driscoll about specific statements referenced in the note, including claims that Eric kept drugs hidden in an allergy pill bottle in his work truck and confided in Corey's brother about getting high. Nestor asked whether investigators had independently verified those claims, such as speaking with the individuals mentioned or searching their phones. The detective testified that investigators attempted to contact at least one person referenced in the letter, but were unable to interview him and did not search his phone. The defense also questioned whether the letter had ever actually been delivered to anyone, with O'Driscoll stating that he did not believe it had been shared. But what the jury didn't hear is that it wasn't shared because she never sent it, because she was in jail when she wrote it and it never got sent out before it was found. Nestor also questioned the detective about the handling and testing of evidence connected to Carmen Lauber. She challenged whether suspected pills recovered during the investigation were ever analyzed and suggested gaps in how the evidence was processed. O'Driscoll indicated that questions about specific testing would be better answered by another member of the investigative team. In addition, the defense asked about other digital and investigative findings, including phone data and various leads mentioned during testimony. Through this line of questioning, the defense appeared to be highlighting areas where additional verification or follow-up may not have occurred as part of the investigation. The court adjourned late in the afternoon and picked up the following day at 8:30 a.m. Day 13 is where things got absolutely insane for me. The prosecution had stated that they were going to rest, and the defense surprised everyone by saying that they also were going to rest. They were not going to call any witnesses in Corey's defense, and Corey was not going to take the stand. At that point, when both prosecution and defense said that they were going to rest, this was on Thursday. The judge told the jury to go home until Monday and report back at 8:30 in the morning to hear closing arguments and jury instruction. On Friday, the day, I did not watch all of the happenings with that. It was just the judge and the attorneys. Corey also was present, going over different information about instructions for the jury. On Monday morning, they began with the judge reading detailed jury instructions, reminding jurors that closing arguments are not evidence and that any verdict must be unanimous. Prosecutors then laid out their theory of the case, arguing that financial struggles, alleged efforts to obtain drugs, and digital evidence all pointed to a calculated plan to poison Eric. They told jurors there was no other rational explanation for the evidence presented during trial. The defense fired back, urging jurors to focus on reasonable doubt. Attorneys argued that the state had failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt and cautioned jurors not to judge Corey's grief or demeanor in the chaotic hours after her husband's death. They maintained that she did not kill Eric and suggested investigators built a narrative instead of finding proof. After rebuttal arguments from the prosecution, the judge instructed the jury on how deliberations would proceed. Jurors were then formally excused to begin deciding Corey's fate, marking the final phase of one of Utah's most closely watched trials. Backing up a little bit, after the prosecutors gave their closing arguments, the jury was excused for a bathroom break, and Corey's attorney, Kathy Nestor, tried to appeal that they needed a mistrial because of things that the prosecution said during their closing statements. And the prosecution did highlight how Corey's reactions to things has been very interesting to watch throughout the trial. I noticed a lot of Corey's facial expressions did not come in traumatic times where you would think that they would happen. When body cam footage of Corey finding out that her husband passed away, she remained stoic. She was very stone cold, no emotion at all. As they showed video of her sister-in-law finding out that her brother was dead, Corey showed no emotions. body cam footage of, you know, the room when Eric is literally on the floor getting CPR done. Corey remained, again, stone-faced, no emotions. But the only time that she ever really showed emotions was when people were testifying on the stand about things about her that she, it almost seemed like, didn't like hearing. Whether it be conversations that she had had, the way that she had acted at some point or another, or her finances, she would make faces, sometimes mouth what at the witnesses, and her brows were furrowed. She was making like a WTF kind of face. You guys probably saw some of the pictures that are circulating. Everybody's talking about it. And there was a time that, like I said, when Eric's business partner was on the stand, she mouthed what? But the jury was released to deliberate. And in a shocking turn of events here for me as well, they deliberated for 2 hours, 57 minutes, and 25 seconds, which that completely shocked me. I thought that they would for sure be out at least a couple of days through, I was going to guess probably through Friday, into next week at the latest, but I was shocked. They deliberated for less than 3 hours and they reached a verdict of guilty on all charges. Corey was found guilty of aggravated murder. She was also found guilty of attempted murder, 2 counts of insurance fraud, and 1 count of forgery. After the verdict was read, the jury was released, and the sentencing date was scheduled for May 13th, 2026. And this is a very significant day because May 13th happens to be Eric's birthday. And after I realized that that was Eric's birthday, I went back and watched the reaction of Corey when they were talking about the sentencing day, and she showed no reaction at all to the fact that that was her husband's birthday. Eric would be turning 44 this year, and it's just so crazy. And I will say that when they read the guilty verdict, she did have her head up. And prior to them reading the verdict, the judge made sure to address everybody, including Corey, including the family in the gallery. Like, there will be no outbursts. If you feel overcome with emotion, you need to look down. You need to put your head down. Do not make a sound. Do not have an outburst or an outcry or start yelling or anything like that. So he made that very clear that he was not going to tolerate that. So when they read the guilty verdict, and again, you can go and find this on YouTube, but she just, you could see like she took a deep breath and she just looked down, she put her head down, and she did not look up again as each verdict was read as guilty. Now, I, of course, covering all of this, I wanted to give like my unbiased opinion. However, I do believe that I think that the jury got it right. I do believe that there was enough circumstantial evidence to prove that she was guilty. I worried, though, about how the jury would feel about things. I feel like there were times where the defense really did point out, you know, missteps in the investigation and the lack of testing of certain things or the lack of documenting of other things. So I was relieved that the jury did find her guilty. However, I am sure that there is going to be appeal after appeal, and it will just be a matter of time to see what all happens with that. I also want to say that I absolutely adore this judge. If you guys have never listened to anything like any videos of him talking, you gotta go look it up because he has the greatest podcast voice of all time. But I have to say, throughout the entire trial, he was fantastic. He was so patient, so kind. He treated everyone with respect. I thought he did a fantastic job, and I would love to watch another trial that included him because he was just so great. Okay, guys, I want to know your thoughts, your opinions, so make sure that you are a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I encourage everyone to share all things true crime. You can also follow me on Instagram at CrimeAholly. I also am on Facebook. It's my personal Facebook page, but you can hit the follow button and see my true crime posts on there as well. I covered this case extensively during the trial, and I had a lot of fun doing that. It was a little tough to keep up with daily life, but we made it work. All right, guys, I will try and get that other full-length episode out for you guys. I really appreciate all your patience, the kind words, and if you all could say just a quick little prayer for my Bindi Lou. She's only 9 years old, and I know labs don't live forever. They don't live nearly as long as what we wish they could, but I am not ready. I'm not ready for her to go. My kids are not ready, and I am not ready to try and have to be strong for my babies. So if you guys could just keep my little Miss Bindi Loodles in your thoughts and prayers, I would so greatly appreciate it. And I will see you guys next time. Until then, be aware and take care. Bye-bye.